Good morning and welcome to a special Main Street Radio broadcast from the International Wolf Center in Ely. I'm Rachel Reedy. This corner of northeastern Minnesota is mostly wilderness, lots of lakes and trees and solitude. It's the natural habitat for the wildlife we'll be discussing, the gray wolf and the black bear. These mostly shy, elusive creatures are the target of an unprecedented wave of interest, research, and in some cases, controversy. Let's begin the first hour of our show focusing on the gray wolf, also called the timber wolf. 25 years ago, they were a species nearly hunted to extinction by humans. The only significant wolf population left in the 48 contiguous states was here in northeastern Minnesota, where several hundred wolves remained. The federal government stepped in, and the gray wolf was among the first species to be officially considered endangered. Today, the gray wolf is back, rebounding with a vigor that has surprised even some of the experts. Minnesota now has almost 2,500 gray wolves, and the federal government plans to remove them from the protected list. That process, though, took a sharp detour this year when the Minnesota legislature failed to pass a wolf management plan. With me at the International Wolf Center in Ely is their resident wildlife biologist, Bill Rowdy. State Senator Gary Leidig, a Stillwater Republican who co-authored the wolf management legislation, and Mike Don Carlos, a wildlife specialist from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, who's working on the wolf management plan. Joining us from our studio in St. Paul is Ron Ress-Snyder, a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who is drafting the proposal to remove the wolf from the federal protected list. Welcome, gentlemen, to Main Street. Our phone lines are also open for your calls and comments. You can reach us today at 1-800-537-5252. That number again, 1-800-537-5252. It was announced earlier this month that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is delaying a national proposal to take wolves off the federal endangered species list until at least October. Ron Ress-Snyder, why the delay?
Well, we had drafted a proposal based upon the Minnesota Wolf Management Plan that the DNR had produced and released back in February. And since that plan wasn't approved by the legislature, it was difficult for us to make a decision based upon that proposal alone. So what we're doing right now is reassessing other alternatives. We're looking at some other actions we could take that might be a little bit different than the original proposal. And that's going to take us a couple months' worth of time to go over those other alternatives and to develop an alternative proposal, and that's what we're doing right now.
Once your proposal is made public, possibly in October, how many months, then, will you leave open for public comment?
I think we'll probably leave it open for about 4 months. For most proposals will go 60 days, something like that, but this is going to be quite a bit more controversial than an average endangered species listing or delisting proposal, so we'll give the public plenty of time to comment. We'll have public meetings during that period of time and probably a number of public hearings as well.
Senator Leidig, what happened in the Minnesota legislature? It seemed like by the time they came up with the consensus from the 33-member Citizens Roundtable, that was the difficult part, and people assumed that it would sail through the legislature because it had that broad base of support already. The tough work had already been done, and then it was killed in the legislature. What happened?
It was not killed in the legislature. I think there was...
It was wounded in the legislature.
Well, I think it's a difference between citizens involved in policy and politicians involved in policy, and when you have Minnesotans involved in policy, they succeed. When you bring politicians in, you don't always succeed. Unfortunately, the House leadership did not support the Citizens Roundtable agreement. The legislation, which the department very thoughtfully put together, was not given to an advocate. The House leadership gave the legislation to the chair of the House Agricultural Committee, who was also an author on legislation which provided for hunting, trapping, and predator control. So I think the House leadership gave the legislation to a non-supporter of the roundtable agreement. The Senate, I think, had a better opportunity. We had a number of hearings. This bill took a very interesting route. It went to the Environment Committee. It went to an Environment Budget Committee. It was referred back to the Senate Ag Committee. It then went even to the Senate Crime Prevention Committee. back to the Rules Committee and onto the floor of the House, where it was about two or three votes short of passing. And so I think the Senate is very close to adopting the Citizens Roundtable Agreement, which is the legislation the department proposed.
Although now the news out this week is the Department of Natural Resources is coming up with a wolf management plan that could perhaps provide stricter population controls on the wolf than what was agreed upon by the Citizens Roundtable. Mike Don Carlos, what can you tell us about that?
Well, that's correct. The commissioner recently has asked the department staff to take a fresh look at the wolf management issue, and we will be doing that later this summer and into the fall. There haven't been any discussions yet, and there is no alternative plan, but we're simply going to just relook at the issue and see where we are, and hopefully make a good determination on how to proceed.
You spent months working with the Citizens Roundtable. 33 people, farmers, hunters, environmentalists, Native Americans, cattlemen, animal rights advocates, all the players were there. Some people said a consensus would never happen from that group. And then it happened. Did that surprise even you?
Yes, it surprised me. I would be one of those people who predicted it wouldn't. It was really quite surprising. But if you actually went through the process, I guess it was a little maybe less surprising. I think that the weight of the responsibility of deciding something, you know, eventually is what turned the group and turned the corner. And I think we all realized that, you know, if it can't happen here, it's not going to happen.
And you didn't want a hung jury.
Right.
So you came out with the plan, you presented it to the legislature, and was it at the point you said, it's finished?
No.
You worked with the legislature too long, perhaps.
Right. We never expected that it would be finished. We expected that it probably would be modified by the legislature, but we were hopeful that the modifications would be more semantic than substantial, and that the core of the agreement would go through well enough that the roundtable would agree that the final outcome was what they had agreed to. And unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Ron Refsnyder, your office, your agency is working on a wolf management plan. Now the DNR is taking another look at a wolf management plan. Then the legislature's going to get it again. Are these groups kind of all working independently at this point?
Well, to some extent they are. The Fish and Wildlife Service is a federal agency, and we don't feel that we have the authority to tell the DNR how wolves should be managed in Minnesota. That's an issue for the DNR and the citizens of the state to decide. So we're pretty much staying out of the details of the wolf management plan for the state itself. We have a federal wolf recovery plan that's been in existence actually since 1978 and was revised in 92. And the states and federal agencies all cooperated in putting that plan together and in carrying it out. But that is a recovery plan. That's to get the wolf to about the point where it is today. That plan doesn't include and doesn't look forward into the future and say how wolves should be managed after federal protection is removed. That's up to the states.
I think that Mike Don Carlos, I think, has to be commended publicly. It was early in 1995 or 96 that the Department of Natural Resources looked ahead toward the potential that the federal government would remove the timber wolf from the federal protection list. The Department of Natural Resources came to the legislature with a very thoughtful proposal to hold a series of statewide public meetings. I believe there were 12 statewide public hearings where citizens were told about the federal delisting process, told about the population, and an opportunity to give the Department of Natural Resources their thoughts about state management. That then led to a population survey, because we really need to know how many wolves there are in Minnesota before the federal government is going to allow it to be delisted. The third part of the DNR plan was the Citizens Roundtable. This was a group of 33 diverse Minnesotans, staffed by biologists, federal government, state government, and they worked for over 5 months. And on a Friday evening in Duluth, after a final two-day hearing, everybody came together in a very delicate balance. Wolf advocates did not want to see the animal shot. Livestock wanted the opportunity to protect their property. And the delicate balance, the deal that was struck, is that wolf advocates will allow livestock owners to kill wolves that were attacking their animals, and the livestock groups agreed there'd be no hunting and trapping. That was the deal. There were a number of wolf advocates that literally were crying Friday evening when that deal was struck. It was the wolf advocates that came to the legislature and promoted this deal. Regrettably, the Farm Bureau and the Livestock Association, after participating in the Citizens Roundtable, then went to the legislature and decided they could get a better deal working with the House of Representatives. So unfortunately, three or four groups that agreed to a compromise and agreed to a consensus and pledged to support the roundtable turned their backs and went to the legislature. That's where the disruption occurred.
Our phone number today is 1-800-537-5252. If you have a question or a comment, call us and join this conversation. We go now to Aiken, where Dale Lewick from the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association is standing by. Good morning, Mr. Lewick.
Good morning. Minnesota State Cattlemen certainly like to thank Public Radio for hosting this program. It's really helpful to ensure we get accurate information to all the citizens of Minnesota. And first, I certainly cannot let Senator Leidig's comment concerning the agriculture people that he just made go unanswered. First of all, it's not true. We did not abandon the roundtable. Basically, what Senator Leidig did in the Senate was try to force lock, stock, and barrel everything in that roundtable agreement down the legislators' throats. And what he forgets is that those senators in the Senate really truly represent people in Minnesota. They don't represent the round table. They represent the constituents. And they have a duty and a responsibility to respond to their constituents, not the round table. They took a lot of things, a lot of good things out of the round table and adopted them, and then they changed some things and they added some things. But for Senator Leidig to submit that because the round table produced something, the rest of the elected representatives in the state of Minnesota now should fail to represent their constituents' viewpoint on a whole lot of issues is ridiculous. But anyway, to get on, I've got a couple of questions. One I'd like to direct to Mike Don Carlos, and that is, in view of Senator Leidig and Senator Krentz's absolute abysmal failure to carry a majority of senators in the Senate for their position, and they caused tremendous rancor amongst a lot of middle-of-the-road senators because they were going to jam this down those people's throats, like it or not, will the DNR next year reach out to moderate senators like Senator Stump, Senator Dallas Sams, Senator Steve Dill, who have shown they've got a majority in the Senate right now, and can produce a workable wolf bill? The only reason we didn't get a wolf bill out of the Senate this year was Senator Krentz and Leidig chose to prohibit the senators to even vote on the final version. That's the only reason, and that lies directly with Senator Krentz and Senator Leidig. There's no one else responsible for that.
Let's allow Mike Don Carlos a chance to respond to your question. Your question was, will the DNR work with the legislatures for a new bill?
And the answer is yes, certainly if the legislature asks us to. We've always been willing to do that. But as I said earlier, Dale, we've just recently been advised by the commissioner that he wants us to revisit this issue, and we will. And we're going to consider, you know, a whole range of options, including just what you talked about, is working with key legislators.
Well, maybe I could quickly respond. Mr. Lewick, if I were you, I would be the last person to call in on this program. As you know, I've informed you and other representatives that there's no need to talk to me about any further legislation because what you agree to one day will change the next. I'd like to come to your Cattle Association annual meeting where you will explain to your members that you helped kill a legislative proposal that would allow your association members to shoot and destroy wolves attacking livestock, to harass and drive off of your property by any stalking wolves, and that would continue federal involvement in the removal of nuisance wolves. That's what you killed. And what you have now, Mr. Lewick, is the animal continues to enjoy total protection by the federal government. You killed a plan that provided to the agricultural community all of the safeguards and tools they needed. And by killing that, you have continued total protection. So this summer, when your members call you and say, wolves are harassing and destroying my livestock, tell them that you killed the bill that would allow them to shoot that wolf. And by doing that, they cannot do anything to protect their property.
Appreciate your flattery, Senator Leidig. But the facts are, and the people of Minnesota need to watch what Senator Leidig does, not what he says, because there's different as night and day. There are two people that laid that bill on the table and prevented the citizens' elected representatives from voting on the bill that Senator Stump and the majority of the Senate amended. The two people that laid that bill down and prohibited our representative form of government in Minnesota from working are Senator Leidig and Senator Krentz, and I think we ought to move on, and that's the facts. You can go check the record. They are the ones responsible for no wolf bill.
We are going to move on.
Yeah.
This show is coming to you live from the International Wolf Center. Our phone number is 1-800-537-5252, and our phone lines are full of people with questions and comments. We will go now to Hinckley, where Janet is standing by. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. I want to just step back a minute, and I really have to differ with the accusation that the cattlemen or the livestock producers were the ones who stepped out of line away from the agreement first. And to even say that we ever did step out is incorrect. A very crucial part of the roundtable agreement that was repeatedly brought up was that the livestock producers did not want to do anything that would interfere with the timely delisting of the wolf. And we had the promise of the wolf advocates present at the round table that if we came to an agreement with them, that they would allow delisting to occur on schedule. Within 1 month after we agreed to that round table agreement, the Minnesota Wolf Alliance, which consisted of at least two people that were advocates of the wolf at the round table, and two of the organizations that were present there, announced that they were going to sue to stop delisting anyway because of a different set of reasons than they had previously stated. But the point was is that they were going to, their intention was to stop delisting no matter what. But while we negotiated at the round table, they said if we agreed to no hunting and trapping, then they would not interfere with delisting. And they immediately turned around in October and walked out on the round table agreement. So I think, first of all, it's extremely wrong to accuse the livestock producers of being the ones who first reneged on this agreement.
Thank you for your comment, Janet. We go to Longville now, where Tom is standing by. Again, our number, 1-800-537-5252. Good morning, Tom. Your question, please.
Yes, for Ron Rapschneider, Rep. Tom Myers, the Conservation Federation guy. I have heard a rumor, and I can't remember where, that the Timberwolf recovery plan or the recovery team had met sometime this spring and forwarded recommendations to the service, I guess presumably in the form of a letter. Can you clarify this?
The recovery team has been meeting periodically as events have unfolded in the wolf scenario in Minnesota, and after, let me think, I believe it was after the Minnesota DNR released their wolf management plan, the recovery team did meet and they provided us with a letter that basically said that that plan, if it would be approved and enacted, would result in a wolf population that would be viable in Minnesota for the foreseeable future. And that was basically the question we had presented them with. Would this plan do what the recovery plan, the federal recovery plan, required of future wolf management after federal delisting or federal protection was removed? And they assured us that the DNR's plan that was released in February would do that for the wolf population. Now I understand the team is also now working on a subsequent recommendation that we haven't received yet, and that recommendation is basically what they would recommend we do now since that plan has not been approved.
Thank you for your question, your call. We go now to Aiken. Joanne is on the line. Good morning, Joanne. Joanne, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. I'm just supporting environmental education as a way to get younger people to understand what these issues are about. Everybody in the different houses and the Senates converse on these issues. Our children can't even connect to that. What they need to do is, and I sent my child to a Wolfridge Environmental Center last year, and that was just great for her to learn about the wolves and all the different aspects of nature. So I think it starts there, and all of us can argue as much as we want about these different issues, but until the people learn from really younger ages, I don't think that good decisions will be made. So I guess that's my comment. Thank you.
Bill Rowdy, you are the biologist here at the International Wolf Center. Is that what you're all about?
Yes, that is what the International Wolf Center is all about, trying to provide information to the public. And it is very important that the public, in all issues dealing with wildlife, becomes educated, supports legislation and legislators who provide a good legislation for wildlife management, support the DNR and others who are conducting wildlife management activities. And so that's exactly what we're all about, trying to reach out to especially young people who are in need of information. And we try to do that through magazines, our website, and all kinds of information that we provide here on
site. And your building is full of people learning. There are kids now in Wolf Camp this morning. There was a group of Boy Scouts in the classroom yesterday, and I see the classroom's full again this morning. So this is an ongoing process here.
Yes, we bring about 50,000 people a year through the center here.
We go now to Little Fork. We have Mary on the phone line. Good morning, Mary. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. I object to the repeated statements that the round table represented the people of Minnesota. It certainly did not. It did not represent me or anyone I know. It was a panel of special interest groups that were dominated by strict preservationists and animal rights advocates. As always, these groups chose to become militant advocates for a species that affects agriculture because it gives them an opportunity to regulate agriculture. The results of that roundtable were proof of this. Almost all of the recommendations regulated agriculture and strictly prohibited regulating the wolf. Now, I, for one, do not want roundtables making decisions for me. I'd rather take my voted legislator that I voted for or won by a majority represent me. The roundtable did not rule by majority. It was a consensus thing. Now, in reality, the consensus was achieved by a 2-vote, which means that the people did not support the content, but that they wanted consensus. Well, I guess we'd all like to have
why
consensus.
Why did the Department of Natural Resources go the route of the Citizens Roundtable? What were you hoping to achieve there?
Well, as you and probably everybody involved in today's program knows, we have a long history in Minnesota of arguing about wolf management and what it should look like, and especially after federal delisting. And we've not been successful in a number of processes, including the political process to date, in resolving the issue. In a nutshell, what the department wanted to do was to go right to the interest groups and the citizens and get all of the viewpoints at the table and start developing the concepts of a plan, rather than sort of assume and, you know, make our professional judgments and then turn that out. And the prediction was that everybody would hate it and, you know, that we'd reach a stalemate. So we just wanted to start right with the public at the front end rather than the back end. I'd like to make a couple of comments to Mary about the consensus process and the roundtable. First of all, it definitely was comprised of interest groups. But we believe that the whole range of those interest groups represented all of the wolf interests that were out there. We strove hard to do that, and we asked the roundtable to make additions and corrections to the group itself in order to accomplish that. And I think the simple fact that nobody demonstrated against the process illustrates that everybody was inside and in the room and participating. Secondly, the consensus process was part of the power, because if all the interests were there and every single interest had the opportunity to agree with or stop the process, then you get away from this need to determine how many votes should one side have versus the other side. And that was the beauty of that process. It's true that, on a five-vote scale, that most people voted a two for the final agreement. I should tell you that I voted a two on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources. And not to belabor the point, the two was the lowest vote that you could vote and agree. But I think in retrospect that was almost inevitable because the divisiveness on this issue is so extreme, it's virtually impossible to get a consensus agreement that everybody would really like. And the point is that we did have a consensus agreement that everybody agreed they could live with. And I think that was really really an important moment in the history of wolf debate in Minnesota. And finally, I'll say it was always acknowledged that the legislature would be the final decision-making authority, and that was clear throughout the roundtable process. This was just simply a method to try to provide the legislature guidance directly from the public on the issue.
You're listening to a special Main Street Radio broadcast from the International Wolf Center in Ely. I'm Rachel Reedy. We're talking about wolves. My guests are Ron Refsnyder with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Mike Don Carlos of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Bill Rowdy of the International Wolf Center, and Minnesota State Senator Gary Leidig. NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. You can go to npr.org. We'll be back with more of Main Street after a look at news and weather.
I'm Lorna Benson on the next All Things Considered. As the bear population continues to rise, we explore the human fascination with the unpredictable animals.
They have five fingers and five toes, and when they stand up, they're about our height, and they look kind of like us.
That story plus all the day's news on the next All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
With news from Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Greta Cunningham. White House officials are denying that Wesley Clark is being forced out as NATO's top commander in Europe. Clark is giving up his command next May. That's 2 months early. Press Secretary Joe Lockhart says any suggestion that the commander of the Kosovo air campaign is being punished would be ridiculously wrong. Clark is being replaced by General Joseph Ralston, currently vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The Pentagon says Ralston's move to the European job will preserve his four-star rank. Lockhart says President Clinton has the highest regard for Clark. The Senate is debating a Republican plan to cut taxes by almost $800 billion over the next decade. President Clinton promises to veto the Republican plan if it reaches his desk in its present form. Some Democrats suggest a $500 billion cut would be both politically and fiscally more responsible. But Clinton aides say he rejects that one as well. The Republican plan was passed by the House last week on a largely party-line vote. It would give Americans their biggest tax break in nearly two decades. The temperatures are sizzling again across much of the nation today, and now at least 41 deaths are being blamed on the recent heat wave. The Central Plains are expected to get the worst of it, with temperatures forecast above 100 in some parts. Health officials are urging people in hot spots to check on neighbors, especially the elderly. In regional news, a thunderstorm brought another half inch of rain to the Austin area last night, pushing the city's rainfall total for July to more than 9.25 inches. Heavy rain a week ago prompted flood warnings for the city, but rivers and streams have since returned to normal levels, and last night's rainfall did not cause additional problems. There is a heat advisory in effect for southeastern Minnesota this afternoon through tomorrow. It will be very warm statewide today, with high temperatures near 85 in the north to 95 in the south. There's also a chance of an afternoon thunderstorm statewide. Checking current conditions around the region, mostly sunny skies. St. Cloud reports sunshine in 76. It's sunny in Rochester in 78. Sunny in Duluth and 74. And in the Twin Cities, sunshine, a temperature of 79 degrees. That's a check on the latest news. I'm Greta Cunningham.
Welcome back to our Main Street special, live from the International Wolf Center in Ely. I'm Rachel Reby, and our panel of wolf experts include State Senator Gary Leidig, Wolf Center biologist Bill Rowdy, and Mike Don Carlos of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, who are all in Ely with me, and Ron Refsnyder of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who is joining us from our St. Paul studio. Listeners, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-537-537. 5252. At this time of year, Ely, a quiet town of 4,000 people on the edge of the Boundary Waters canoe area, becomes a major tourist destination. Seems like every other vehicle on the highway into town is wearing a canoe or two. The grocery stores are full, the restaurants are crowded, and Ely is humming. Many of the people passing through Ely stop here at the 6-year-old International Wolf Center. They check out the exhibits, attend lectures, and watch videos about wolves. But the main attraction here is the three resident wolves. Here at the Wolf Center, a wall of windows in front of us overlooks the wolf yard. Our Main Street reporter, Leif Enger, is outside in front of the enclosure. Good morning, Leif.
Hi, Rachel. I'm standing at the edge of the wolf enclosure. It's basically a small clearing dotted with a few boulders and some tall weeds and backed by a grove of aspen and birch and white pine. And inside, as you mentioned, are three wolves, gray wolves, timber wolves. You might recall the press that these animals got when they were brought in as pups 6 years ago. They were cute, and they were named Lucas and Lakota and Mackenzie. They looked like stuffed animals on a store shelf. And now, cute, as I'm watching them here eating some fresh beaver tail, is not an adjective that I would choose. They're tall and rangy, and they lope, and they leave footprints that would make ranchers nervous, and they have the famous baleful glare. And standing here with me is Andrea Lorick Strauss, who is the education coordinator here at the Wolf Center. And Andrea, these animals certainly look wild. Are they wild?
Certainly they're wild. As Lakota puts her nose to the fence, it might be hard to imagine that. They are wild, however. They are not pets. They're not domesticated. These animals would not know how to handle themselves in a human environment. Are they wild, though? They live in an enclosure. They get food prepared for them. So each one of us has a definition of wild. But their nature is still very much that of the wild. They could not be trained to, you know, stay off the couch. They could not be trained to come when called. They are not trainable. They are very much their own creatures, and that's what we consider wild.
The enclosure is built right next to the auditorium, as Rachel mentioned, so visitors can watch them through the glass. So how much is that like seeing wolves in the wild?
Well, we have them in a natural setting, and this is the only chance most people will have to actually see a wolf. And so this is good enough for most people. And we do also try to conduct programs that include travels out into the wilderness. But these guys are the stars, Lucas, Lakota, and Mackenzie. These are why people come. This is what they want to see when they're here. And sometimes they're really disappointed when the wolves aren't out. So
how do you use these wolves, these three wolves particularly, in your programs?
We consider these wolves to be ambassadors for their kind that are in the wild as well. They represent their species in that their physical features are identical, their behavior is identical, their circumstances, as I mentioned, are a smidge different. But because they are so similar, when Lakota stands on that rock like she is right now, people can see what those eyes look like. They can see how big those feet are, what the fur looks like. Because these wolves are here, people get a real sense for what this animal is really like.
When do you feed them? What do you feed them? How much do you feed them?
We try to keep their lives as natural as to what they'd have in the wild as possible. And so wolves in the wild don't eat all that often. We feed these guys once a week.
What do you feed them?
Roadkill deer, again, trying to keep it natural.
Should be plenty of that around. You mentioned the wolves as ambassadors. Does seeing these animals have an effect on visitors' perceptions of wolves, do you think?
Certainly. People are often surprised by what they see. They expect the wolves to be big and furry, and at this time of year, they look a little skinnier than what you might expect. People go away feeling surprised that the wolves spend a lot of time sleeping, for example. They expect wolves to be hunting or pacing or doing something dramatic all the time, and really, these are wild animals.
Are you changing attitudes about wolves, or are you already speaking to a house full of wolf lovers every day?
No matter who our audience is, we hope we're challenging assumptions. We want people to understand the scientific facts. We want people to understand the things we know objectively through documented information. We want people to understand this animal for what it really is, not for all of the human constructs that surround the animal, both positive and negative.
What happens to the pack when these get old? They're 6 years old now. You mentioned to me earlier that in the wild, that's pretty much a wolf's lifespan.
A wolf in the wild might live as long as 8 years. Wolves have been known to live 13 years in the wild. But these wolves are getting to be about middle age, we think. we already have plans underway for introducing some new puppies into our situation next summer. We may eventually be able to introduce them to the pack itself, but in any case, puppies will be an important educational piece for us, we hope, next summer, so watch for that.
How do you expect that to go?
Well, we're planning for it now. We expect to acquire them from a reputable breeder. It's, of course, illegal to take wolves from the wild. We will raise the puppies so that they're comfortable around humans, and then by the time they're maybe 5 months old, we will introduce the wolves to each other, the adults and the pups, see how well they get along and if the adults will accept the pups into their social structure.
I think you said the enclosure is about an acre and a quarter. Is that big enough for 5 wolves?
We think so. We think this enclosure could support perhaps 6 wolves.
What happens if these wolves, which as you say are wild, get out?
We don't expect that they'll get out. We're very careful about that. However, if some strange thing should occur, we think they wouldn't survive very well in a wilderness setting, truly without any human support. They've never had to hunt for themselves. They probably wouldn't be able to find a place to live. There are wild wolves just about everywhere in this area right now, so they might not find a territory.
The wolf that's right here is which one?
This is Lakota, and you can tell it's Lakota because on her nose she has a black cowlick of hair that's distinct from the other wolves we have. Lucas is distinguishable because he doesn't have that cowlick. He also has a scar on the inside of his right leg. Mackenzie is easy to tell. She's the darkish wolf, blackish almost, and on days like this she's very, very warm, so she's less likely to be seen.
Very rangy, and yet they weigh around 100 pounds.
These wolves do. Wolves in the wild may not weigh quite this much because these wolves have a pretty comfortable life. They don't get as much exercise as a wolf out in outside the enclosure might get, and they certainly have plenty of food.
The wolf is mostly identified with its howl. And understanding that these animals are not programmable, we have a Wolf Center staffer stationed behind the building. And he is going to howl, and we're going to see if we get a response.
All right. Now, again, as we mentioned, wolves are not programmable, but we sometimes like to encourage them with stimulus. We have Lakota, whose ears are moving back and forth, checking out that noise. Her ears are in opposite directions right now. They're moving. The muscles are very attentive on a wolf's ears. She's definitely noticing. I noticed Lucas in the enclosure earlier, too. Typically, when we howl like this, they'll perk their heads up. Look around. They're very curious. This is definitely a stimulus that is keen for them.
Are they actually fooled?
Oh, no. We don't have any illusions that they think we're wolves. These wolves will even respond to the fire sirens that come past. But clearly, it's a very strong stimulus for them.
Checking out the microphone, but not apparently willing to howl. Thank you, Andrea. I appreciate the time, and going after the beaver tail here. Rachel, that's about the best we're going to be able to do. Back to you.
Thank you, Leif. I'm Rachel Reeby. We're live at the International Wolf Center in Ely. We are talking about wolves with our panel of guests. Our phone lines are open. You can call in with your questions or comments, 1-800-537-5252. Bill Rowdy, Leif was asking Andrea about the change of attitudes towards wolves. There actually was a survey done in 1972 about how people feel about wolves, and another survey was done this year. What did you come up with? Are people changing the way they look at wolves?
Well, actually, that survey was done in 1985 and now again in 1999. And Dr. Steven Kellert from Yale University conducted the research on both times. And so we initiated the study this year, trying to get a good handle on where the public was. And there isn't a great shift. I mean, people are greatly divided on the wolf issue, and I think, if anything, that's what can be said about wolf management. And the previous caller, Mary, stated that the public had their opinions and that they needed to be listened to, guided by the legislature. And from the Kellert survey, we really found out that things haven't changed that much, and that the public is so divided on so many issues, it's really difficult to get people together on some of these issues, although there are some that fall out. You know, the public is, for example, slightly against public harvest, except for farmers who encourage public harvest. In terms of range, it's highly variable. People, in some cases, south and north residents are about split on whether or not wolves should be allowed to range across the state, whereas farmers are opposed to having wolves range across the state. However, the south, people from the southern part of the state were split on whether wolves should be restricted only to the north. Northern residents were opposed to having wolves restricted simply to the north, probably because they want to say, well, if everybody down there likes wolves so much, why, maybe they should have some.
And we still see about half the people support hunting wolves and about half of the people oppose hunting wolves. 53-47%?
Yeah, public harvest, slightly greater than 60% of southern residents were against a public harvest, and slightly more than 50% of northern residents were against a public harvest. However, greater than 60% of farmers were for a public harvest.
Mike, is this something that the DNR looks at? Should they have a wolf hunting season? Or I know the roundtable was for at least 5 years hold off on instituting wolf hunting in Minnesota.
Well, I think that public harvest, whether it's trapping or hunting, is probably the single most divisive issue in wolf management. And the way the roundtable addressed it was to simply defer it. And that may sound like the easy way out, but I think maybe there's some logic in that. By deferring resolving the issue of public harvest, it allows us to get our feet wet, so to speak, with state management after more than 20 years of federal management.
Get the wolf off the list, then take
That's
a look
right.
at what happened.
That's right. And so the roundtable, didn't take a position on public harvest. It just simply said that we agreed that we would defer consideration for 5 years.
Why would somebody hunt a wolf? You certainly, people don't eat wolf, do they?
Well, I've never heard of it.
Just for the sport of it? For the fur?
For the sport of it, for the trophy value. There, formerly was a commercial value in wolves and wolf fur.
Well, I would just like to say that there was one clear thing that came out of the Kellert survey, and that is that there was a strong majority of Minnesotans who wanted to see the wolf delisted and put back into the state management hands, and that they had real good confidence in Minnesota DNR in managing the species. So that was a clear indication that the public wanted this thing to move ahead, be delisted, and put back in the state government hands.
Now, if we could only agree on how to do that. Our phone number, 1-800-537-5252. We have a caller on the line from Williams. Good morning. Welcome to Main Street.
What I'd like to say is I have worked with agriculture, worked with farmers and livestock owners for something like 20 years. I raised sheep myself where there were coyotes as well as wolves and coy dogs. I become familiar with what they're going to do, and my management practices reflect that. I guess I see a lot of livestock owners expecting to use public land as well as their own land. It's sort of a mismanagement. They're not watching their livestock. They're not taking the precautions that they should. And I see this firsthand. Farmers get real... And I can't say I blame them. I mean, the way the market is right now, the price of beef and everything else going down, but still don't blame it on nature, I guess you can say.
Have you ever had a loss from wolves?
You Pardon?
Sheep? Have you ever lost a sheep to a wolf?
I have never lost a sheep from wolves or coyotes because I guess I'm watchful, and I don't see a lot of that from other livestock owners. They sort of put the livestock out there and, oh, she might be pregnant, but, just let her out there. Well, that's not the thing to do, If you've got something, if you got an animal that's pregnant, bring it on in a little closer, Don't just stick it out there in the back 400 expecting nothing to happen. It's
Mike Concarlos, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that farmers, livestock owners can learn ways of managing their herd so perhaps to minimize wolf involvement?
Well, I'm speaking now from a Minnesota perspective, and I would say to a very limited extent in Minnesota.
as the caller states, it is true that livestock husbandry can contribute to wolf depredation, but it is also true, and perhaps more significant, that you can do everything right raising livestock in Minnesota and still be vulnerable to wolf depredation. Some of the comments about bringing animals in for calving and that just simply aren't feasible in some of the livestock operations as they're commonly practiced in Minnesota. So it's easy to fix the obvious problems like, you know, avoiding carcass dumps that attract wolves and those kinds of things, but it's really hard to absolutely prevent depredation. It's going to occur, and it needs to be addressed to the satisfaction of livestock producers.
We go now to Garrison, where Ralph is standing by. Good morning, Ralph. Welcome to Main Street.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm on a cell phone. Excuse me. I was one of the Wolf Roundtable delegates, and I've listened to part of this show, and I've caught flack from a number of organizations and just individual citizens. I take somewhat of a defensive posture because I feel that the round table, even though it was loaded with emotions, did the best we could with the tools we had. And I was listening to, I believe, a caller called Janet talking about how it may have been biased against agriculture. I was one of the individuals that pushed for the legislation to be slanted toward allowing a farmer to actively shoot a wolf depredating cattle, actually caught in the act. I think if the people were to read the minutes and understand all that went on, there was more than what most people realize. And I want to applaud Mike and Bill Rowdy and the whole gang up there. I think they know who I am calling here. I think we all did a good job, and we're doing the best we can for this thing. It's just too bad that politics plays such a big part in the management of this creature. And I guess that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, Ralph. Dennis is in Minneapolis. Good morning, Dennis. Welcome to Main Street. Dennis, go ahead with your question or your comment. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just address this issue of hunting. I think it's a species issue as it regards the wolf, particularly in Minnesota, when we debate whether the animal should be hunted or not be hunted, because in point of fact, and the DNR knows this well, and most people who know about wolves know it, the wolf cannot be hunted effectively in Minnesota, and perhaps in most places actually of the world. And so the argument of whether people should go out and be allowed to hunt or not be allowed, really I think the clearer issue that should be laid out is, what should be the boundaries for the wolf, and how will those wolf boundaries be established? Because the primary factual imbalance, it seems to me, among most people about wolves, particularly in Minnesota, is that they do not understand that wolf management, wolf population control, is a key issue here, and that hunting is not an effective means, a net effective component of wolf management population control. The discussion to me about hunting is a hot button. It's kind of easily visited by both sides, but a difficult undertaking for anybody to go out and actually find a wolf and shoot it. And I think if there were such a season, it wouldn't last very long because it wouldn't be a satisfying means of hunting for most anybody.
Do you agree with that, Mike?
Yes, I do. hunting and trapping and public taking are all terms that are used to describe public harvest. But I would agree that hunting without the use of aircraft is not likely to be effective in population control. I think the trapping programs, depending on how they're managed, could produce population control, at least at the local level.
NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant-making, leadership training, and convening. We are halfway through this Main Street broadcast from the International Wolf Center in Ely. My guests have been Mike Don Carlos with the DNR, Ron Refsnyder with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, State Senator Gary Leidig, and Bill Rowdy of the International Wolf Center. I'm Rachel Reby. Next hour, we're turning our attention to the black bear. Although they haven't been as controversial as wolves, black bears have received their share of attention. Minnesotans love their bears, but is there room in this state for 27,000 of them? Join us next hour in our panel of bear experts as this Main Street special from Ely continues after the news.
Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 28th of July, 1999. It's the birthday of the poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins, born Essex, England, 1844. Loved to write poetry as a young man, but forsook it when he joined the Roman Catholic Church and took vows as a priest, said, "It does not belong to my profession." He kept making notes for poems in his journals, however, and after a few years, one of the priests under whom he studied encouraged him to try poetry again. Shortly afterward, he wrote his poem that begins, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed." Almost none of his poetry saw the light of day during his life. He died of typhus at the age of 44, and only about 20 years later did his work begin to appear in print. It's the birthday of the poet and novelist Kenneth Fearing in 1902 in Oak Park, Illinois, best known for his free verse that often incorporated newspaper and advertising jargon. It was on this day in 1914 Austria declared war on Serbia, which was the beginning of World War I. It was about exactly 1 month after a Serbian nationalist had assassinated Archduke Ferdinand of Austria at Sarajevo. The war eventually pitted Austria, Germany, and Turkey against France, Britain, Russia, and then the United States. It's the birthday in Rochester, New York, 1927, poet John Ashbery, whose collection Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize in 1975. And it was on this day in 1932, about 15,000 World War I veterans, known as the Bonus Army, gathered in Washington, D.C., demanding immediate payment of benefits for their military service. They'd come from all over the country. They were camped out along the Anacostia River during the Great Depression. The veterans wanted early lump sum payment of pension funds, which Congress had approved in 1924, but which were not due to be paid until 1945. The Bonus Army was orderly until Congress voted against granting them the benefits. Most of the protesters then left, but 5,000 stayed, began rioting, and President Hoover called in the army, which used tear gas and tanks to break them up. Here's a poem for today by William Butler Yeats. An Irish airman foresees his death. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross, my countrymen Kiltartan's poor. No likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath. A waste of breath, the years behind, in balance with this life, this death. A poem by William Butler Yeats from 1919. An Irish airman foresees his death. From selected poems and four plays published by Scribner Paperback Poetry and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, July 28th, made possible by the people at 21 North Main, sellers of used, rare, and out-of-print books, and supporters of national literacy campaigns. Research by Brian Newhouse. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs. I'm Rachel Reby, and we'll continue our Main Street special from Ely, where we're talking about Minnesota's black bear.